collectors, rhymesters, and drummers. Some thoughts on beauty and on rhythm, written for my own entertainment early in the 1990s and revised for this book. Collectors. People collect things. So do some birds and small mammals. The vizcacha, or bizcacha, is a little rodent that digs holes in Patagonia and the Pampa and looks like a very round prairie dog with rabbity ears. Charles Darwin says, "The bizcacha has one very singular habit, namely dragging every hard object to the mouth of its burrow. Around each group of holes, many bones of cattle, stones, thistle stalks, hard lumps of earth, dry dung, etc., are collected into an irregular heap. I was credibly informed that a gentleman, when riding on a dark night, dropped his watch. He returned in the morning, and by searching the neighborhood of every bizcacha hole in the line of road, as he expected, he soon found it." This habit of picking up whatever may be lying on the ground anywhere near its habitation must cost much trouble. For what purpose it is done, I am quite unable to form even the most remote conjecture. It cannot be for defense, because the rubbish is chiefly placed above the mouth of the burrow. No doubt there must exist some good reason, but the inhabitants of the country are quite ignorant of it. The only fact which I know analogous to it is the habit of that extraordinary Australian bird, the Calodira maculata, which makes an elegant vaulted passage of twigs for playing in, and which collects near the spot land and seashells, bones, and the feathers of birds, especially bright-colored ones. The Voyage of the Beagle, Chapter 7. Anything that left Charles Darwin unable to form even the most remote conjecture has got to be worth thinking about. Pack rats and some magpies and crows are, I gather, more selective than bizcachas. They, too, take hard objects, but keep them in their nest, not outside the front door. And the objects are generally notable in being shiny, or shapely, or in some way what we would call pretty, like the gentleman's watch. But like the bizcachas, clods, and bits of dung, they are also notable in being absolutely useless to the collector. And we have no idea what it is they see in them. The male bowerbird's collection of play pretties evidently serves to attract the female bowerbird, but has anyone observed crows or magpies using their buttons, spoons, rings, and can pulls to enhance their allure? It seems rather that they hide them where nobody else can see them. I don't believe anyone has seen a female pack rat being drawn to the male pack rat by the beauty of his collection. Hey, honey, want to come down and see my bottle tops? My father, an anthropologist with interests that ranged from biology to aesthetics, kept a semi-permanent conversation going, like the famous 30-year-long poker game in Telluride, on the subject of what beauty is. Hapless visiting scholars would find themselves at our dinner table hotly discussing the nature of beauty. An aspect of the question of particular interest to anthropology is whether such concepts as beauty or gender are entirely constructed by each society, or whether we can identify an underlying paradigm, a universal agreement throughout most or all societies of what is man, what is woman, what is beautiful. Somewhere in the discussion, as it gathered weight, my father would get sneaky, cross species, and bring in the pack rat. It is curious that evidence for what looks like an aesthetic sense, a desire for objects because they are perceived as desirable in themselves, a willingness to expend real energy acquiring something that has no practical end at all, seems to turn up only among us, some lowly little rodents, and some rowdy birds. One thing we three kinds of creature have in common is that we are nest builders, householders, therefore collectors. People, rats, and crows all spend a good deal of time gathering and arranging building materials and bedding and other furniture for our residences. But there are many nesters in the animal kingdom far closer to us genetically than birds or rodents. What about the great apes? Gorillas build a nest every night. Zoo orangs drape themselves charmingly with favorite bits of cloth or sacking. If we shared any collecting tastes with our closest relatives, it might indicate a deep grammar of beauty, a deep aesthetic. In all us primates, or at least in the big fancy ones. But alas, I know no evidence of wild apes collecting or prizing objects because they seem to find them pretty. They examine objects of interest with interest, but that's not quite the same as stealing something because it's small and shiny and hiding it away as a treasure. Intelligence and the sense of beauty may overlap, but they aren't the same thing. Chimpanzees have been taught or allowed to paint, but their motivation seems to be interactive rather than aesthetic. They appreciate color and evidently enjoy the act of whacking the paint on the canvas, but they don't initiate anything remotely like painting on their own in the wild, and they don't prize their own paintings. They don't hide them, hoard them. It appears that they're motivated to paint because people they like want them to paint. Their reward is less the painting than the approval of these people. But a crow or a pack rat will risk its life to steal something that offers no reward of any kind except its own shiny self. And it will hoard that stolen object of beauty, treasuring it and rearranging it in its collection as if it were as precious as an egg or an infant. The interplay of the aesthetic with the erotic is complex. The peacock's tail is beautiful to us, sexy to the peahen. Beauty and sexual attractiveness overlap, coincide. They may be deeply related. I think they should not be confused. We find the bowerbird's designs exquisite, the perfume of the rose and the dance of the heron wonderful. But what about such sexual attractors as the chimp's swollen anus, the billy goat's stink, the slime trail a slug leaves for another slug to find so that the two slugs can couple, dangling from a slime thread on a rainy night. All these devices have the beauty of fitness, but to define beauty as fitness would be even more inadequate than most reductionist definitions. Darwin was never reductionist. It is like him to say that the bowerbird makes its elegant passage for playing in, thus leaving the bowerbird room to play, to enjoy his architecture and his treasures and his dance in his own mysterious fashion. We know that the bower is attractive to female bowerbirds, that they are drawn to it, thus becoming sexually available to the male. What attracts the females to the bower is evidently its aesthetic qualities, its architecture, its orderliness, the brightness of the colors, because the stronger these qualities are, the greater the observable attraction. But we do not know why. Least of all, if the sole end and purpose of the bower is to attract female bowerbirds, do we know why we perceive it as beautiful? We may be the wrong sex and are certainly the wrong species. So, what is beauty? Beauty is small, shapely, shiny things like silver buttons which you can carry home and keep in your nest or box. That's certainly not a complete answer, but it's an answer I can accept completely, as far as it goes. It's a beginning. And I think it's interesting, puzzling, important, that my appreciation of small, hard, shapely, shiny things is something I share with bizcochas, pack rats, crows, and magpies of both sexes. Rhymesters. Humpback whales sing. The males sing mostly in breeding season, which implies that their songs play a role in courtship. But both sexes sing, and each humpback population or nation has its distinctive song shared by all citizens. A humpback song, which may last as much as half an hour, has a complex musical organization, structured by phrases, groups of notes that are the same or nearly the same in each repetition, and themes, groups of repeated similar phrases. While the humpbacks are in northern waters, they don't sing very much, and the song remains the same. When they regroup in the south, they all sing more, and the national anthem begins changing. Both the song and the changes in it may well serve to confirm community, like street slang or any group jargon or dialect. Every member of the community learns the current version, even when it is changing rapidly. After several years, the whole tune has been radically altered. We will sing to you a new song. Writing in Natural History in March 1991, Carrie B. Payne asks two questions of the whales. How do you remember your song, and why do you change it? She suggests that rhyme may help in remembering. Whale songs with a complex set of themes include rhymes, phrases that end similarly, and these rhymes link one theme to the next. As for the second question, why they keep changing and transforming their communal song, she says, "Can we speculate about this and about whales' use of rhymes without thinking of human beings and wondering about the ancient roots in nature of even our aesthetic behavior?" Payne's article reminded me irresistibly of the poet-linguist Del Himes's work on oral narratives in his book In Vain I Tried to Tell You and other books and articles. One such observation, summarized very crudely, is of the value of the repetitive locutions that mark divisions in Native American oral narratives. Such locutions often begin a sentence, and if translated, appear as something like, "So then," or "Now, next it happened," or just "and," often discarded as meaningless, as noise, by translators intent on getting the story and its meaning. These locutions serve a purpose analogous to rhyme in English poetry. They signal the line, which, when there is no regular meter, is a fundamental rhythmic element, and they may also cue the larger structural rhythmic units that shape the composition. Following such cues, what was heard, translated, and presented as a primitive, purely didactic, moralizing story, given what shape it has merely by the events it relates, now can be appreciated as subtly formal art, in which the form shapes the material and in which the seemingly utilitarian narrative may actually be the means toward an essentially aesthetic end. In oral performance, repetition does not serve only to help the performer remember the text. It is a, perhaps the, fundamental structuring element of the piece, whether it takes the form of the repetitive beat of meter, or the regular sound echo of rhyme, or the use of refrain and other repeated structures, or the long and subtle rhythm of the lines in unmetered poetry and formal oral narrative. To these latter are related the even longer and more elusive rhythms of written prose. All these uses of repetition do seem to be akin to the whale's rhymes. As for why the whales sing, it is certainly significant that they sing most, or the males sing most, in mating season. But if you could say a song lasting half an hour, performed by 100 individuals in chorus, is a mating call, then you could say a Beethoven symphony is a mating call. Sometimes Freud sounds as if that's what he thought. If, as he said, the artist is motivated to make art by the desire for fame, money, and the love of beautiful women, then indeed Beethoven wrote the Ninth because it was mating season. Beethoven was marking his territory. There is plenty of sexuality in Beethoven's music, which as a woman one may sometimes be rather edgily aware of. Thump, 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 bang. But testosterone goes only so far. The Ninth Symphony reaches way, way beyond it. The male song sparrow sings when his little gonads swell as the light grows in the spring. He sings useful information, didactically and purposefully. "I am a song sparrow. This is my territory. I rule this roost. My loud, sweet voice indicates my youth and health and wonderful capacity to breed. Come live with me and be my love. Tee-diddle, wee too, it-a-little-little." And we hear his song is very pretty. But for the crow in the next tree, caw, said in several different tones, serves exactly the same function. Yet to us, caw has negative aesthetic value. Caw is ugly. The erotic is not the beautiful, nor vice versa. The beauty of birdsong is incidental to its sexual or informational function. So why do songbirds go to such elaborate, formalized, repetitive trouble, learning and passing songs down from generation to generation as they do, when they could say caw and be done with it? I propose an anti-utilitarian, non-reductionist, and of course, incomplete answer. The bower bird builds his bower to court his lady, but also, in Darwin's lovely phrase, for playing in. The song sparrow sings information, but plays with it as he does so. The functional message becomes complicated with a lot of useless noise because the pleasure of it, the beauty of it, as we say, is the noise, the trouble taken, the elaboration and repetition, the play. The selfish gene may be using the individual to perpetuate itself, and the sparrow obeys. But being an individual, not a germ cell, he values individual experience, individual pleasure, and to duty adds delight. He plays. After all, sex, mere sex, may or may not be pleasurable. There's no way to check with slugs or squids, and judging by the hangdog expression on the faces of dogs having sex, and the awful things cats say while having sex, and the experience of the male black widow spider, I should say that if sex is bliss, sometimes it doesn't much look like it. But sex is inarguably our duty to our genes or our species, so maybe, to make the duty more enjoyable, you play with it. You fancy it up. You add bells and whistles, tails and bowers, pleasurable complications and formalities. And if these become an end in themselves, as pleasures are likely to do, you end up singing for the joy of singing. Any useful, dutifully sexual purpose of the song has become secondary. We don't know why the great whales sing. We don't know why pack rats hoard bottle caps. We do know that young children love to sing and to be sung to, and love to see and possess pretty shiny things. Their pleasure in such things precedes sexual maturation and seems to be quite unconnected to courtship, sexual stimulation, or mating. And while song may affirm and confirm community, stealing silver watches certainly does not. We cannot assume that beauty is in the service of either sexuality or solidarity. I wonder if complication and uselessness are not key words in this meditation. The pack rat seems like a little museum curator because she has complicated her nest-building instinct with meaningless noise, collecting perfectly useless objects for the pleasure of it. The humpback whales can be mentioned along with Beethoven because by adding meaningless noise to simple mating calls and statements of community, they elaborated them into symphonies. My husband's Aunt Pearl employed a useful craft, crochet, with the useful purpose of making a bedspread. By making useless, highly rhythmic variations on plain crochet stitch, she complicated the whole act enormously because she enjoyed doing so. After months of pleasurable work, she completed a beautiful thing, a spider web coverlet, which she gave us. Although it does indeed cover a bed, it isn't, as we women say, for every day. It is useful, but not simply useful. It is much more than useful. It was made to put on the bed when guests are coming, to give them the pleasure of seeing its complex elegance and the compliment of being given more than is strictly necessary, a surplus, a treat. We take what's useful and play with it for the beauty of it. Silent drummers. When people are talking about beauty in art, they usually take their examples from music, the fine arts, dance, and poetry. They seldom mention prose. When prose is what's being talked about, the word beauty is seldom used, or it's used as mathematicians use it, to mean the satisfying, elegant resolution of a problem, an intellectual beauty having to do with ideas. But words, whether in poetry or in prose, are as physical as paint and stone, as much a matter of voice and ear as music, as bodily as dancing. I think it is a major error in criticism ever to ignore the words. Literally, the words, the sound of the words, the movement and pace of sentences, the rhythmic structures that the words establish and are controlled by. A pedagogy that relies on the cliff notes sort of thing travesties the study of literature to reduce the aesthetic value of a narrative to the ideas it expresses, to its meaning, is a drastic impoverishment. The map is not the landscape. In poetry, the auditory and rhythmic reality of language has stayed alive all through the centuries of the Gutenberg hegemony. Poetry has always been said or read aloud. Even in the inaudible depths of modernism, T.S. Eliot was persuaded to mumble into a microphone. And ever since Dylan Thomas wowed him in New York, poetry has reclaimed its proper nature as an audible art. But prose narrative has been silent for centuries. Printing made it so. Book circuit readings by novelists and memoirists are popular now, and recorded readings of books have gone some way towards restoring orality to prose, but it is still generally assumed by writer and by critic that prose is read in silence. Reading is performance. The reader, the child under the blanket with a flashlight, the woman at the kitchen table, the man at the library desk, performs the work. The performance is silent. The readers hear the sounds of the words and the beats of the sentences only in their inner ear. Silent drummers on noiseless drums. An amazing performance in an amazing theater. What is the rhythm the silent reader hears? What is the rhythm the prose writer follows? While she was writing her last novel, Points Hall, which she refers to as PH in this reading, and which, when it was published, became Between the Acts, Virginia Woolf wrote in her diary, "It is the rhythm of a book that, by running in the head, winds one into a ball, and so jades one. The rhythm of PH, the last chapter, became so obsessive that I heard it, perhaps used it, in every sentence I spoke. By reading the notes for memoirs, I broke this up. The rhythm of the notes is far freer and looser. 2 days of writing in that rhythm has completely refreshed me, so I go back to PH tomorrow." This, I think, is rather profound. Virginia Woolf, Diary, 17th November 1940. 14 years before this diary notation, made near the end of her life, Woolf wrote the passage I used to open this book and for its title, where she speaks of prose rhythm and the wave that breaks and tumbles in the mind. In it, she also, lightly, called her remarks on the rhythm of narrative profound. In both these passing notes on the rhythm of narrative, she knew, I think, that she was onto something big. I only wish she'd gone on with it. In a letter in 1926, Woolf said that what you start with in writing a novel is a world. Then, when one has imagined this world, suddenly people come in. Letter 1618. First comes the place, the situation, then the characters arrive with the plot. But telling the story is a matter of getting the beat, of becoming the rhythm, as the dancer becomes the dance. And reading is the same process, only far easier, not jading, because instead of having to discover the rhythm beat by beat, you can let yourself follow it, be taken over by it. You can let the dance dance you. What is this rhythm Woolf talks about? Prose scrupulously avoids any clear regular beat or recurrent cadence. Are there, then, deeply syncopated patterns of stress? Or does the rhythm occur in and among the sentences, in the syntax, linkage, paragraphing? Is that why punctuation is so important to prose, whereas it often matters little in poetry where the line replaces it? Or is prose narrative rhythm established as well in even longer phrases and larger structures, in the occurrence of events and recurrence of themes in the story, the linkage and counterpoint of plot and chapter? All these, I think. There are a whole lot of rhythms going in a well-written novel. Together, in their counterpoint and syncopation and union, they make the rhythm of that novel, which is unlike any other, as the rhythms of a human body in their interplay make up a rhythm unique to that body, that person. Having made this vast, rash statement, I thought I should try to see if it worked. I felt I should be scientific. I should do an experiment. It is not very rash to say that in a sentence by Jane Austen, there is a balanced rhythm characteristic of all good 18th-century narrative prose, and also a beat, a timing, characteristic of Jane Austen's prose. Following what Woolf said about the rhythm of Points Hall, Might one also find a delicate nuancing of the beat that is characteristic of that particular Jane Austen novel? I took down my complete Austen, and, as in the Sorties Virgiliani, or lazy consultation of the I Ching, I let the book open where it wanted, first in Pride and Prejudice, and copied out the first paragraph my eyes fell on, then again in Persuasion. From Pride and Prejudice. More than once did Elizabeth, in her ramble within the park, unexpectedly meet Mr. Darcy. She felt all the perverseness of the mischance that should bring him where no one else was brought, and to prevent its ever happening again, took care to inform him at first that it was a favorite haunt of hers. How it could occur a second time, therefore, was very odd, yet it did, and even a third. From Persuasion. To hear them talking so much of Captain Wentworth, repeating his name so often, puzzling over past years, and at last ascertaining that it might, that it probably would, turn out to be the very same Captain Wentworth whom they recollected meeting once or twice after their coming back from Clifton, a very fine young man, but they could not say whether it was 7 or 8 years ago, was a new sort of trial to Anne's nerves. She found, however, that it was one to which she must inure herself. Probably I'm fooling myself, but I was quite amazed at the result of this tiny test. Pride and Prejudice is a brilliant comedy of youthful passions, while Persuasion is a quiet story about a misunderstanding that ruins a life and is set right only when it's almost too late. One book is April, you might say, and the other November. Well, the four sentences from Pride and Prejudice, separated rather dramatically by a period and a dash in each case, with a colon breaking the longest one in two, are all quite short, with a highly varied, rising rhythm, a kind of dancing gait, like a well-bred young horse longing to break out into a gallop. All are entirely from young Elizabeth's point of view, in her own mental voice, which on this evidence is lively, ironical, and naive. Though the paragraph from Persuasion is longer, it is in only two sentences. The long first one is full of hesitations and repetitions, marked by 8 commas, 2 colons, and 2 dashes. Its abstract subject, to hear them, is separated from its verb, was, by several lines, all having to do with other people's thoughts and notions. The protagonist of the sentence, Anne, is mentioned only in the next-to-last word. The sentence that follows, wholly in her own mental voice, has a brief, strong, quiet cadence. I do not offer this little analysis and comparison as proof that any paragraph from Pride and Prejudice would have a different rhythm from any sentence in Persuasion. But as I said, it surprised me. The rhythms were in fact so different, and each was so very characteristic of the mood of the book and the nature of the central character. But of course I am already persuaded that Wolfe was right, that every novel has its characteristic rhythm, and that if the writer hasn't listened for that rhythm and followed it, the sentences will be lame, the characters will be puppets, the story will be false, and that if the writer can hold to that rhythm, the book will have some beauty. What the writer has to do is listen for that beat, hear it, keep to it, not let anything interfere with it. Then the reader will hear it too, and be carried by it. A note on rhythms that I was aware of in writing 2 of my books. Writing the fantasy novel Tehanu, I thought of the work as riding the dragon. In the first place, the story demanded that I be outdoors while writing it, which was lovely in Oregon in July, but inconvenient in November. Cold knees, wet notebook. And the story came not steadily, but in flights. Durations of intense perception, sometimes tranquil and lyrical, sometimes frightening, which most often occurred while I was waking early in the morning. There I would lie and ride the dragon. Then I had to get up and go sit outdoors and try to catch that flight in words. If I could hold to the rhythm of the dragon's flight, the very large, long wing beat, then the story told itself and the people breathed. When I lost the beat, I fell off, and had to wait around on the ground until the dragon picked me up again. Waiting, of course, is a very large part of writing. Writing Herns, a novella about ordinary people on the Oregon coast, involved a lot of waiting. Weeks, months. I was listening for voices, the voices of four different women whose lives overlapped throughout most of the 20th century. Some of them spoke from a long time ago, before I was born, and I was determined not to patronize the past, not to take the voices of the dead from them by making them generalized, glib, quaint. Each woman had to speak straight from her center, truthfully, even if neither she nor I knew the truth. And each voice must speak in the cadence characteristic of that person, her own voice, and also in a rhythm that included the rhythms of the other voices, since they must relate to one another and form some kind of whole, some true shape, a story. I had no dragon to carry me. I felt diffident and often foolish, listening as I walked on the beach or sat in a silent house for these soft, imagined voices, trying to hear them, to catch the beat, the rhythm that makes the story true and the words beautiful. I do think novels are beautiful. To me, a novel can be as beautiful as any symphony, as beautiful as the sea, as complete, true, real, large, complicated, confusing, deep, troubling, soul-enlarging, as the sea, with its waves that break and tumble, its tides that rise and ebb.